Chapter 8, Remarks. Miscellaneous objections. We close this work with a few miscellaneous remarks, most of which deal with some objections that may arise in certain situations. An objection that one highly intelligent critic actually expressed was, that he thought that my story was similar to ones he had read about flying saucers and divining rods. The reaction was startling, but it was at least understandable. Years of propaganda have so associated Nazi Germany with the 6 million legend, that denial of the legend seems at first almost as preposterous for many people as denying that World War II happened at all. Nevertheless, the objection is not one that can be answered, except by pointing out that our account does not involve the supernatural or extraterrestrial or, indeed, anything more unusual than people lying about their political enemies. With this critic, one can only ask that he attempt to say something intelligent. The most consequential objection to this work will be that I have employed the Holocaust literature, in particular the books by Reitlinger and Hilberg, as sources, although I have also denounced such books as monumental foolishness. This objection is a serious one, because I would be the first to hold that, once the extermination legend had been buried, these books will become significant only as supreme examples of total delusion and foolishness, and will be referenced only in connection with the great hoaxes of history. However, our task here is precisely to bury the legend, and the only way to do that is by considering the story that has been advanced, and this amounts to analyzing the case put forward by Reitlinger and Hilberg. The only practical way of exposing the hoax is by considering the claims that have been put forward by the extermination mythologists. There was a second reason for employing Reitlinger and Hilberg as sources. In this work, great weight had been placed on providing documentation that a reader without access to a large library can confirm on his own. Unfortunately, this desire could not be entirely satisfied, because a good part of the analysis relies on documents and publications that are not readily available, without going through complicated borrowing procedures. In order to partially overcome this difficulty, I have used Reitlinger and Hilberg as sources on many such points, but I have only done this in cases where I have been able to confirm their remarks. I have not adopted the practice of assuming that anything that Reitlinger or Hilberg says that helps my case must be true. For example, in connection with our discussion in Chapter 5, page 203, concerning the date of the first Allied air raid at Auschwitz, I gave reasons for the conclusion that the first raid did not occur before August 1944. It would have been dishonest to merely reference Hilberg on this point, because Hilberg believes that the first raid occurred in December 1944, and is obviously confused on this point. Another reason for the frequent referencing of Reitlinger and Hilberg is my sincere wish that the reader would take a look at such books. It is only then that the reader can become completely convinced that the hoax is a hoax. In this connection, one can recommend a typical procedure that the reader may go through to confirm the matter in a general way. First, get a copy of Hilberg's book. On pages 567 to 571, Hilberg presents a magnificent discussion of the alleged role of the Zyklon B in the exterminations, and on page 619 or 621, he points out that the German documents speak only of a program of deportations to the East and associated operations. It is also useful to read his discussion of what the Nuremberg trial documents say happened in Hungary, 509 to 554, and to note the document numbers he cites in this connection. Next, find, if possible, a copy of Reitlinger's book, first or second edition. On pages 158 to 159, 150 in the first edition, he reproduces the text of document NO 4473, in which he notes that the gas chamber that allegedly existed in the building which contained Crematory 2 at Auschwitz was described as a Vergasungskeller in the original German. On pages 118, 121 and 182, 112, 114 to 115 and 169 in the first edition, Reitlinger remarks on the quote-unquote mystery that, quote, at certain periods, entire transports of Jews were admitted into Auschwitz, unquote. Reitlinger also briefly mentions the chemical industry at Auschwitz, pages 109 and 492, 105 and 452 in the first edition. Hopefully, the reader will undertake a more thoroughgoing confirmation, but the above would be a good start. Some people may assume, fallaciously, that opinions expressed by Jews and Germans on the subject of the Final Solution carry nearly authoritative weight. Under circumstance where the subject of this book is being discussed by a group of people, a seemingly potent argument, because it is so laden with emotion and can upset the decorum of the group, may be offered by a Jew who claims to have lost some relative or close acquaintance in the Holocaust, and he may even have knowledge that the supposedly missing relative had been sent to Auschwitz, Treblinka, or some such place. There are several ways to react to such a point. An obvious possibility is that the man is lying. However, it is more probable that he is telling the truth as he knows it. Assuming that his story is valid, there is only one sense in which it can be valid. That is, All he can claim is that he or his family lost contact with some relative in Europe during the war, and never heard from that person again. Obviously, such data does not imply the existence of a Nazi extermination program. That contact was lost during the war was almost inevitable, either because it was difficult for Jews deported to the East to communicate with people in Allied countries, or because it was difficult or impossible to communicate from the East to points farther west during the chaotic last year of the war. Thus, the only point of interest in such a case is the claim that contact was not re-established after the war. The simplest explanation is that the relative did indeed perish somewhere in Europe during the war, or in a concentration camp, from causes that have been covered in this book, along with an indeterminate number of other persons of Central and East European nationalities. The second possibility is that the relative survived the war, but did not re-establish contact with his pre-war relations. One possible, although not very likely, motivation for such a failure to re-establish contact could have been some prohibition on such correspondence, imposed by the Soviet government on those Jews who had been absorbed into the Soviet Union. A more important and more plausible motivation for failing to re-establish contact held, when a separation of husband and wife was involved. A very large number of marriages are held together by purely social and economic constraints. Such constraints didn't exist for a great number of the Jews uprooted by the German policies in wartime and post-war conditions. In many cases, deported Jewish families were broken up for what was undoubtedly intended by the Germans to be a period of limited duration. This was particularly the case when the husband seemed a good labor conscript. Just as German men were conscripted for hazardous military service, Jews were conscripted for unpleasant labor tasks. Under such conditions, it is reasonable to expect that many of these lonely wives and husbands would have, during or at the end of the war, established other relations that seemed more valuable than the previous relationships. In such cases, then, there would have been a strong motivation not to re-establish contact with the legal spouse. Moreover, none of the social and economic constraints, which we noted above, were present, and Jews were in a position to choose numerous destinations in the resettlement programs that the Allies sponsored after the war. This possibility could account for a surprisingly large number of quote-unquote missing Jews. For example, suppose that a man and wife with two small children were deported, with the man being sent to a labor camp, and the wife and children being sent to a resettlement camp in the East. Let us suppose that the wife failed to re-establish contact with her husband. We thus seem to have four people reported dead or missing. The husband says his wife and children are presumably dead, and the wife says her husband was lost. However, this one separation of husband and wife could account for even more missing Jews, for it is likely that the parents and other relatives of the wife, on the one hand, and the parents and other relative of the husband, on the other, would also have lost touch with each other. Thus, one had some number of people on the husband's side claiming that some number of people on the wife's side are missing, and vice versa. Obviously, the possibilities of accounting for quote-unquote missing Jews in this way are practically boundless. It is said that the Yad Vashem archives in Jerusalem now have the names of between 2.5 and 3 million Jewish, quote, dead from the Nazi Holocaust, unquote. The data have supposedly been collected on one-page testimony sheets filled in by relatives or witnesses or friends. Of course, it is in no way possible to satisfactorily substantiate this production of the Israeli government, which certainly cannot be claimed to be a disinterested party in the question of the number of Jews who perished. There is no doubt that many Jews died during the war, so we should expect that a part of the Yad Vashem claim is valid, but it is also the case that there is no possible way to distinguish, in this data, between Jews who actually died during the war, and Jews with whom the signers of the testimony sheets have merely lost contact. The data is particularly meaningless when it is a quote-unquote friend who has contributed a declaration. I have lost contact with a great many former friends and acquaintances, but I assume that nearly all are still alive. Indeed, the use of the testimony of friends for the purpose of gathering the Yad Vashem data shows that the data is mostly meaningless. Such friends have no more basis for declaring their missing acquaintances dead than I do. I have no idea what is meant by the witnesses who sign the testimony sheets. There is also a better than negligible possibility that some signers of these declarations invented missing friends and relative for any of a number of possible motivations, and it is even possible that some of the signers never existed. To summarize our reaction to the claims of Jews regarding persons said to be victims of the Holocaust, such claims are no doubt valid to some extent, because many Jews died, but the hard data possessed by Jews who report such losses, when they are reporting truthfully, is not conclusive in regard to the deaths of the persons involved, and certainly in no way implies the existence of a Nazi extermination program.